Here's one. Thank you, Your Honour. Just two clarifications, which is a record for me, only two. First thing, can we add to the rubbish bin paragraph 6.15 as well? Turned out there was a breakout on the western front.
6.15.
So if we can add that to the list, that will make my lunch more pleasant. So 6.15. And then just on the comment on the nitrogen rich forecast, I just want to be really clear for the record that that does just measure nitrogen, and it doesn't specifically measure other contaminants. I'm just going to make that clear. Mr. Allen's evidence does address the extent to which it may be a proxy for other contaminants, but I don't want to overstate that. It is just nitrogen. I'll ask Ms. Edwards to put our first one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Sarah Farmers calls Andrew Gillen.
I do. First time I said those words, I got married 25 years ago, so I hope it's not a problem.
Can you please confirm for the call that your full name is Andrew Peter McGibbon?
It is.
And you're a dairy farmer in Te Aroha, which is outside the TC1 catchment area?
Yes.
And you're also a former Federated Farmers Waitara Provincial President?
Yes.
And you're a Fonterra supplier?
I am.
You've prepared two statements of evidence, a statement of primary evidence dated the 28th of July and a statement of rebuttal evidence dated the 11th of August.
Yes.
And those are found at volumes 304, tabs 9 and 10. Do you have any corrections that you want to make to your evidence?
No.
Can you please confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
To the best of my knowledge and belief, it is, yes.
You also attended the Farm Systems Conference and signed the joint witness statement dated 13 September 2023. Thank you, Mr. McGibbon. Please remain seated and answer any questions my friends or the court have.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Gilman.
Good morning.
Just to start with Annexure AM to your evidence, which is a map produced by Federated Farmers.
What page is this?
In the bundle, it's volume 304,
yes.
Page 488.
Is that what primary evidence?
Yes, it is. Page number, and it's page 488.
Oh, it's sort of through my evidence, so is it paragraph 15, 16?
It's right at the end, it's just after the last page of your text. So page 52 of your document, page 488 of volume 304.
Okay, so an overview of the Tanzania area, is that you want?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, that's it. So I just want to just explore your property arrangements a little. And looking at that inset there, there's two red shapes there. A larger one, and that larger shape there is that. I understand.
Well, I think over the page is the larger scale version.
Yeah, that might be handy. Let's look at that one. So on this one, it's actually green rather than red, the shape I'm looking at. So
looking at that, there's four parcels of land there, and three of them are owned by your wife and one by your grandfather's trust, is that right?
That's right, yep.
Okay, and then that yellow shape to the right of the page there, that's your feedlot, which provides supplementary feed to the main dairy grass.
So it's a leased cut and carry block to maize and individual grass hog.
Right, okay. And it's leased being the important point. Okay, so at paragraphs 177 and 178, you raise concerns that your farm default to discretionary status because one of the four main parcels is owned by Grantville's Trust, that's not common ownership, and non-adjacent feed block is leased, so again, it's not common ownership. So it'd be treated as not treated as a single property under the council's proposal. And you're referring in particular to Rule 3.11.4.4, Condition 5, and I don't expect you to know these provisions in detail or anything, but I do want to just get through it. So just in front of you on the table, at the corner of the table, there's a copy of the council's proposed provisions, just right in front of you, to your right, on the corner of the table. Just in the corner of the table. That's it. On page 26 of those provisions. Sorry, page 28. So on this page we've got part of Rule 3.11.4.4. And condition 5, I just want you to, can you see that about halfway down the page, condition 5, page 28?
The use of land and farming occurs on one property or more than one property within a single operating unit, where those properties are illegal and consumed.
Correct, so yeah, they're called a meaning, that it does say, doesn't it? One property or more than one property within a single operating unit. Now that takes us, so we've established that you only have one property in terms of that definition, haven't we? And that takes us really into this question of whether you're a single operating unit. So I'll go now to page 78, which is the glossary. And there's a definition there of single operating unit towards the bottom of the page. And I just want to step through this definition with your farm in mind, your farm arrangements in mind. So the first one is means farming that occurs on one or more parcels of land. So you've got more than one parcel of land, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And the definition includes non-adjacent land, and you've got non-adjacent land, haven't you, specifically the feed block, is that right?
That's right.
And where the parcels of land support a principal farming activity, so your feed block supports your dairy farming activity, doesn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, yes.
And then finally they are managed as a single integrated unit, and you manage it all as effectively one unit, one farm, don't you?
Yes, correct.
And then those sort of elements seem to be satisfied. And then we have this provision here for the avoidance of doubt, this includes. And then the first one there, a dairy farm and supporting parcels of land used for the purpose of growing feed for the dairy cattle, so that would apply to your farm, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So you can see there that your farm will get treated as one unit for consent purposes. The fact that the parcels are leased or not in common ownership doesn't necessarily breach that condition 5 that I talked to you to at the start.
is where I think, as long as that farming unit or that those parcels of land are being farmed for that farming entity, whether that's growing grass, maize, or grazing their own stock on an adjoining runoff. I mean, my farm system currently would tip over if one of those parcels of land was separated for something else, and you know, wasn't allowed to be used for the sole benefit of keeping that business going.
Yeah, that's, and you're comfortable with that.
Yes,
it gets treated as a single unit for these rules, so that's for the purpose of these rules, so that's not a concern here.
No.
Okay, thank you. So, any other questions here?
Thank you. Mr.
Chairman? No, sir, no questions.
Thank you. Waikato River Authority? No. Mr. Pennell, any questions?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Volunteering here today? No, thank you. Lockheed, sorry? No, thank you. Ms. Brothers?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Holman?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So in the last paragraph of your evidence sheet, you talk about clear and consistent messages needing to be given to farmers. And do you consider that should include messaging on where we are in the journey, so to speak? Firstly, that there's a 2024 plan change coming that may change some targets in certain sub-catchments. Do you think that messaging needs to be included in the plan change?
Well, I think it would be beneficial for farmers to know that. Knowledge is power. So if farmers know what's coming, they can prepare.
Yeah. And the second messaging that might be helpful is, and there was some discussion in your lawyer about this submission this morning, that significantly more may be needed in the future to achieve the longer term goals. Do you think farmers need to understand that as well?
I think they do. We know we've got a path in front of us. We're on the direction of travel. The more we know about key weigh stations in front of us, but once in a better week, you know, that we can clearly identify our targets and move from there. So whether we have future mitigations around technology or farm processes to move that forward, that's what we're working towards.
Mm. All right, thank you. And so just on that, as you know, the plan change has interim target attribute states and long-term target attribute states already. And you would agree, wouldn't you, that understanding how far you are from those, achieving those, is going to be relevant in some way to the way that you develop your farm environment plans, either at a farm level or at a sub-catchment level?
Definitely, you know, but time is key, so we need to have appropriate time to be able to meet those targets, I suppose, or appropriate time, should I say. You know, it's not going to happen in 2 or 3 years, but you know, we've got the 20-year and the 8-year targets.
10-year, actually.
10-year,
yeah. 20, it's supposed to be 20% towards the 8-year target.
It's only been 20 years in our prison.
Yes, that's right, it was. All right, thank you. What about this issue about whether, if a consent is granted, there may need to be a review term on that consent or an ability for the council to undertake a review when the 2024 plan change is made operative? Would you have a problem with that?
I mean, there's going to need to be a review process somewhere along the line, whether it's in a consent process or a farm plan process. So from a farmer point of view, at least for the farm plan, we've got investments in that plan. We've worked with a certified planner, et cetera, to get that plan ahead. Whereas with a consent process, you know, farmers might feel the force into it, we're still getting them standards. So, yes, so, but answers your question, yes, there does need to be review processes for consents and farm plans.
Paragraph 65 of your evidence, and you don't need to go to other products, you give a list of milk supplies in the area, and I believe it's a PC1 area, but it includes open country dairy, Simlay, and Meraka. All three of those companies use overseer, is that your understanding?
I don't know, sorry, I'm not sure about Meraka. I'm a frontier supplier, so that's my own.
Now, you have said in your evidence that initially the Fonterra aggregation risk score didn't mean anything to you, but you do now support the use of the Fonterra N risk scorecard as a drafting gauge in PC1. And you say at your paragraph 174 that compared with overseer, it is easier to determine overseer required a certified nutrient planner to run the program, whereas the N-risk scorecard could be as easy as a farmer entering the inputs into a portal. And the inputs are all data that you are familiar with and you have to hand. Do you have a concern about whether inputs that farmers are going to put into this portal are going to be verified, and the standard of data input that we're going to get with the scorecard approach?
Well, I think it's embedded. We have to do it annually now for our farm insight report for Fonterra. Hence, I haven't renewed any subscriptions with Overseer for about 3 or 4 years now. And out of that has been dropping up the notion of the scorecard, which until this process, I didn't really know much about actually. I tend to, as a farmer, I think it sounds more like nitrogen conversion efficiency, which is obviously helping grass grow and not dropping stuff out through the root zone. So, and that's part of the nitrogen risk scorecard anyway. So.
Yeah, I think you've said in various places of your evidence, haven't you, that you would be concerned if the previous data that you had inputted were used in some way because you didn't know it was going to be used in a way in this team change. And so you're comfortable with Mr. Lemire's proposal that if the NRS scorecard is used, then that basically you start from scratch and you do that within the first 6 months of the plan change becoming operative?
Yes, I mean, we've been well aware that this is going to be used for a registry requirement as well as Fonterra's customer satisfaction, I suppose you might call it. So, I mean, we take a certain amount of care and attention in those figures in there, but we've done the make sure now too, whereas if we're looking at figures from 5 or 6 years ago, I couldn't tell you how I got those figures from.
Okay. Well, we don't have the portal, and we don't have the proposed auditing system. But are you concerned because you have a covered carbon farm and a covered feed pad? Are you concerned that some farmers may enter incorrect data in such a scorecard because we won't have the independent person as the overseer? I'm not saying you would do it. I'm saying other farmers. And forget or not tell the truth and putting things into the scorecard.
My expectation is that Fonterra will have their sustainability advisory people somewhere in the back room to be the auditor, for want of a better word, on those figures that we're putting in. So they'll be monitoring that data that we're putting in, and if they have any questions, they either come out on farm or they give us a call.
Do Just on the work with your covered feed pad and your covered carbon farm, this may be more of a question for Mr. Lemire, but the scorecard provides some points for time spent off pasture during winter, but Overseer provides a lot more. You input a lot more information into Overseer with respect to those sorts of things, don't you? Including whether it's covered, the lining material, the time between eating animals and cleaning a bunker. So Overseer takes into account these things in a lot more detail than the nitrogen risk scorecard.
I don't know. I've never actually filled out an Overseer. The only time I've done Overseer was probably about 7 or 8 years ago with a fertilizer representative, and I can't recall those details.
Would you be concerned if you had covered facilities like that, if somebody else was getting the same amount of points when they didn't have that?
Not really. I mean, I've invested in that infrastructure in order to try and get better environmental outcomes as well as social outcomes for our local community. So I feel like provided I'm doing my bit, I mean, I can't control what our people are doing up there. So farmers, by and large, if not innovators, are early adopters. So they will be, as long as they're following science and you know, doing all that's best for their farm. And that's where the farm plan comes in.
Have you turned your mind to a spirit, when we talked about gateways and the use of the nitrogen risk scorecard and Overseer in this gateway, so to determine whether your permission is controlled or discretionary? And then the second use of it is proposed in the joint federated final state and land track version is in a policy 2, which says that if you're high risk, you reduce to moderate or low as set out in Schedule B, which would, according to this version, contain both the scorecard and the Overseer mechanism. Would you be concerned if there were both those things that certain farmers could pick and choose what was suitable for them and it might not be equitable between the farming sector?
No, I think farmers probably need a choice actually. And she can be, from my expectation, wouldn't have access to the nitrogen risk scorecard in Fonterra. So Overseer is going to be the natural default. Probably other dairy companies may not. Into the nitrogen risk scorecard, so obviously it's going to be the default. So it's really just giving a number in order to determine a gateway for that farm as to whatever is permitted, controllable, or otherwise.
So you're comfortable with it as a gateway. Are you comfortable with it as a mark that if you're high risk, you have to move towards? You're comfortable with that and both those tools for that?
Yes, because I tend to look at the trends. I look at a 3 to 5 year trend on those, either the nitrogen risk scorecard or Overseer, just to give me a direction of travel, which way my farm's going. If it's tracking up, I'm doing something wrong. If it's tracking down, I'm doing something right. So it's giving me a direction of travel rather than a snapshot on that particular day.
Those are my questions, so thank you very much, Mr. McGibbon.
Horticulture, New Zealand, Ms. Ford?
No, sir.
No, thank you. River Iwi, Mr. Foos?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Any reason?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Gilbert. In your rebuttal evidence, you provide a nice photograph, photograph 1 I'm looking at, on page 4 of your rebuttal. Just interested in understanding a little bit more about what that shows us. So
So that commissioner is the primary stream, which was originally a drainage. But it is actually still part of the Waiau catchment drainage scheme. So that constructed a long time ago. It's now become the primary stream, probably rather than primary drain. And they're right through the Waiau, Piako and Harrow catchments, they're originally drainage. This one's part of the Waitoa catchment, the Waitoa River catchment. And so this is a council managed drain, so the council staff come through twice a year and spray the drains for weeds, and every 5 to 10 or so years the mechanical cleanup would do in order to keep it flowing.
So what sort of weed species are they carrying in that particular environment?
Especially when it gets low, there's a lot of water weed, and just rain grass in general, I suppose.
And when they dig it out every sort of 5 to 10 years, what are they removing? What's got in there?
Over time, some of the banks will slump, or there might be trees or branches or something causing obstruction. So it's just wherever there's an obstruction of obstructing the flow. It's a very shallow catchment from our farm through, or from Pyro, for example. Pyro to the first attempt is only 2 or 4 sea, so it's a very slow moving system.
So it might not be every meter of the channel, it will be isolated spots.
Yes, essentially, yeah.
And what do they do with that material?
It's piled up on my farm, and I get to use it around crossing gateways, I guess.
So it's not just sort of mud and stuff like that?
Yeah, it is mud and stuff, but the points it dries out, etc., it becomes sorted.
So it doesn't stay on them, it isn't put on the banks and then get washed back in?
No, that's put probably 4 or 5 metres out. Well, we put outside the fence line, and it's up to himself or the farmer to save it.
So there's a double handling component required there?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Thank you for that.
Good morning, Mr. McGillan. Just in terms of overseer, you said that you've been involved in preparing an overseer file several years ago. Do you use it at all for any other reason on the farm? Does anyone else prepare one for you?
No, I don't know. I used it when it was free, and the fertilizer representatives were using them. I was putting a nutrient budget together for fertilizer purposes, and now overseer FM is a subscription based model. And I think that was the reason why Fonterra has moved away from it as well. So part of our Tiaki report and farm insights is done all through the Washington School Card now.
Okay, thank you, that's good. So how long have you been doing your Tiaki farm plans?
The one I have in my units is the only one I've done so far, which was 2018. So I've now addressed all the concerns or all the actions I needed to do in there, and I've contacted Fonterra about 6 months ago to sit down and review another one, so it's time for review.
Okay, so you don't actually have any trends in terms of your surface nitrogen figure or that sort of thing, is that correct?
No, we do that through our Dairy Insights report, which is an annual report we need to do for Fonterra. That's also in my evidence as well, and that's gives the annual overview of what the farm's doing around stocking rate, crops. It also does nitrogen conversion efficiencies, and that's where the nitrogen risk scorecard got there.
Okay, so and you are seeing a trend. What sort of trends are you seeing?
I'm pretty static, actually. From about 5 or 6 years ago, our in risk scorecard was around about 328, but it's dropped down to, and then due to a probably change in farm practice, I don't know exactly what did it, but it's dropped down to about 230, and we've bounced around about 230 for all the last 3, 4, 5 years.
Did you put in some kind of barn or something for winter use or something like that?
Yes, I did that 2012.
Oh, so that was
12. Yeah. The only change in farm operations is I've leased that Cadden Gary block that I discussed with the council from regional council in 2020. So we've increased, instead of buying 450 tonne of maize, we now grow about 750 tonne.
you get much variability year to year in your purchase nitrogen figure?
No, I use very little nitrogen. It's an artificial fertilizer. In fact, we're probably going to use, well, this year we've used about 50 kilos of ether. That's essentially sulfur ammonia. We use more sulfur than the ammonia. But I don't use urea. I find urea too hard on soil. And most of our purchase nitrogen is coming through purchase feed because we've got a high clinical operation.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions arising?
No, sir.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. McGill. Your excuse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you swear by a mighty God that the evidence you are about to give to this world shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but truth? Okay. Good morning, Mr. Newman.
Good morning.
Can you please confirm to the court that your full name is John Mary Newman?
This is correct.
You're a dairy farmer and a wife by ECU and an open country dairy supplier? You prepared two statements of evidence, a primary statement of evidence dated the 28th of July, and a rebuttal statement of evidence dated the 11th of August. And those are found at Volume 3 or 4, tabs 11 and 12. Do you have any corrections that you would like to make to your evidence?
No, I don't.
Can you please confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief? And you attended the Farm Systems Expert Conference and signed the joint statement dated 13 September 2023, didn't you? Thank you, Mr. Newman. Please remain seated and answer any questions from our friends or the court.
Thank you. Mr. Fisher?
No questions, sir.
No questions, Mr. Mike?
No questions, sir.
Thank you. And Mr. Pinnell, any questions?
Thank you, sir. I guess the court's particularly interested in your evidence as a farmer operating a high input system, and we've got this quandary of overseer versus nitrogen risk, and that states that under the overseer you're a moderate intensity farmer. And under nitrogen risk or high intensity farming. So my question is, how does that impact on how you respond to this that switch that these rules are pointing towards making?
That was my reason for skepticism of the nitrogen risk scorecard because of the two measures that you just alluded to being placed in the high-risk category under the NRS and possibly the political control under the overseas model. We did a bond performed in the area of the farm used for this model after using that nitrogen risk scorecard and got the board removed, putting the inputs from our property into it. We then used it on another property to check the difference in relation to overseas outcome. And here I'm trying to refer you to with me in a minute.
shows the margin used in here, and the difference in the margin of scorecard used was 23% higher. That then concerned me and alluded me to what would I have to do to reduce my margin of scorecard level. And I decided I have to actually reduce the amount of import fees and did a basic model on reducing the amount of import fees, divided the total number of import fees by 13 kilograms of dry matter, because generally 12 to 13 kilograms of dry matter is 12 to 13 kilograms of production is the response from kilogram drying, and then looked at the impact financially. And on that ordinary property, the financial impact on that would mean that our return on capital would be reduced by 2.5%. And it's not about, it's not, the reason I did it is not just for our personal benefit, but for the industry's benefit. And we run that high input system for a number of reasons. One is being profitable and having a return on capital better than the cost of funds, somewhere around about 7%, while employing a better engineering worker and encouraging progression pathways for the dairy industry by doing that. And as the younger sector appears to be struggling with positivity, for Christian pathways, and we're saying we're at the age of 60 and 60, not that old, but we can provide opportunities for them, which we have when we're younger. And this is good for all of the industry, plus it's also good for the economy, because by having a spreading the potential growth of the industry, sharing the growth of the industry, and still achieving a better than return on capital, then if you look at the evidence, you're looking at my rebuttal evidence, annex JNR1. There's a financial survey result from the Waitara AFM. That's a, in that financial result, EFS have inputted approximately 25 farms that they have seen from the Waitara AFM. And they've got the area, land, and so on, with everything in production and profitability and everything in there. I assumed that that land would be worth, on average, maybe $55,000 a hectare. And the plant and equipment to run that property would be worth about $1 million. It's 131 hectares, roughly, the average farm. So that's a total capital investment of $8.2 million. And if we look at the, from the survey, if we look at the farm profit before tax, those figures for 2019, starting from the left, going to 2024.
Which page are you at in the index show?
That's on page.
The long still page, right?
Sorry. Wait a minute, it's on page. This is on page 8 of my
federal
evidence. Shall I continue on?
Yes, please.
So, you look at farm profitability towards the bottom of those, across those annex areas from 2019 to 2024. The return on capital for 2019 is 2.9%, 5.4% for 21-22, 1.6% for 22-23, and 0% for 23-24. So,
So that's the reason I say that there will be make changes that the state is going to speak us. But I want to make it all winter, but I'm saying that the average farmer of the consultants overseeing isn't profitable currently at the moment because their return on capital is less than the cost of funds. We're able to share that with it, and we are profitable. So that concerns me. So obviously we lived it. So now that the scorecard comes into effect, and that's the only model we'll use, we'll have to make a massive reduction in profit and profit sharing. For the economy, it's not that great. And it's also been, through Statistics New Zealand, it's also been modelled that each dollar of profitability that the Waikato dairy farm or any business in the Waikato owns is multiplied 5 times within the year by the time it goes to the economy. So it's pretty much means for every dollar less that the economy is sending in the Waikato, it would be $1.25 tax less to the government.
Okay, thanks for that very comprehensive answer. Just a shorter answer, probably is all required here. Is, the other scenario you're facing broadly is one of going for consent. Have you thought through that possibility, what it might cost you, what you think? The sort of evidence you have to produce to justify staying with status quo or somewhere close to, and have you thought about what sort of success that might mean, what sort of gamble you're taking going down that route?
I think the question is now around that. Yes, I have. Obviously, we would have to keep, currently we're using our assets and embody our information, so we'd have to obviously keep doing that. Time-wise, that's, you know, we found that's 2 or 3 hours a week. Inputting that information, probably a bit more, because the validation and just making sure it's accurate. Then, historically, that's gone into our balance where it is down to come up with a clean result. So we'd have to obviously then put that into regional council or whatever who had the note in the risk scorecard. But what would be more convenient is if we had something similar to the note in the risk scorecard for the use of us as farmers that we could use as preliminary evidence or like a budgeted environmental plan and put in our projected planned inputs of nitrogen or feed inputs or whatever stocking rate, everything that we do, and then see the perceived outcome so that we can determine are we going to try and do this and create an actual, and we're doing this, we'll be lowering our total emissions or main nitrogen surface or increasing it and just keep using it as a model. That would be very convenient because currently, even overseeing now, when we provide the information, we get an end result. But we have no idea what that end result is going to be until it's been entered.
My last question, it sounds like you've done a lot of work working through these numbers, and there's lots of different scenarios you could look at to try and reduce store power value or overseas value, there's a lot of brainstorming required to do that. Have you done this by yourself or have you had assistance? And is it worth investing in some assistance?
Mainly we've done it by ourselves and we keep investigating things. I've tried to use the people that have access to overseer to actually help me or provide evidence to show me how they reach certain score points
very limited. You know, they'll reply in an email saying, yes, if you do this, this might happen. And it's like, it's so insignificant to us to actually use, to adopt, but you know, we're like, technology's changing all the time, and we will adapt if we can, and we're even investigating, we're using the one property folded strain of collection, and minimising the amount that we're actually putting on significantly in that's the first year. That's looking like the results are looking terrific, but we can't use IFSC or London or a scorecard to tell us how it's going to impact the potential outcome, and that's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Newman. I think Mr. Pennell was quite correct. I'm very interested in your evidence because of the fact that you used overseer and the nitrogen risk scorecard. Can you just explain, please understand, I'm not a farmer, so I probably gather that was one of my questions, but I do want to understand properly how this works. So, you've been using overseer for quite some time, is that correct?
Yes, probably.
How long have you been using the nitrogen risk scorecard?
I was only aware that it was a nitrogen risk scorecard until Federated Farmers asked me to be a witness and provide some evidence.
Okay. So have you done any work on trying to assess the nitrogen risk scorecard from your attached to your evidence? The risk scorecard figures with your overseer figures to see if there's any way in which they're linked at all?
Yes, I am.
Please forgive me for not knowing your evidence in detail, but I've probably read 5,000 pages of evidence in the last few
months. I understand. Yes, I did do that, and that's like I pointed out in my initial evidence, but that's just the idea. On page 17, paragraph 71, that is 34 and 23% higher using the nitrogen scorecard compared to my overseer evidence. The previous version said it was 34 and 23% higher. Sorry.
Okay, yes, I have seen those figures, sorry. So that was based on your overseer figure over the 5 years, was it? Or in the same year?
The overseer figure over 5 years, over about, on this specific property, over 4 years, it's not very much. Like it ranged, it varied 1 year, but the range was from basically it was 2 years of 32, 1 year of 34, and 1 year of 49.
Okay, wasn't it? Okay, no, that's good.
Oh, sorry, that's not the purchase margin, that's 4 grams of nitrogen per hectare. Was 67 in 1 year, 145 in another, 122 in another.
67, 145, and 122?
Yes.
Okay. So that is quite a variability.
That is a variability. But it's hard to know why, because the model doesn't show us why. Because the inputs and the production levels on that farm have been so similar. And the inputs have been very similar.
Okay. And those were nitrogen risk scorecards. Nitrogen risk scores, were they? Or were they all?
That was Purchase nitrogen surplus.
Purchase nitrogen, okay. And do you have figures for overseer losses for those same units or not?
Yes. Those 32, 49, 34, 32. So
Can you give us an indication of how much it cost you to run overseer on a typical year, including your own time?
I'm guessing a wee bit, but I think I'm fairly right, Commissioner. I think it's about $700 subscription.
Yeah.
And my own time, it's probably 3 to 4 hours at least per property. Again, that time initially used to be a day, at least a day. But as time's developed, I'm improving my own recording system because I'm aware of using the system.
Right. And you don't have outside advisors coming in at any stage?
No, we don't have the outside advisors on until we mention. The outside advisors collect the inputs that I give them rather than those here.
And is there a charge for that?
I think that's involved in the $700 thing.
Okay. And have you, did you mention that you had worked with Dr. Lemire sometime in the past?
Just prior to giving me minutes, I'm collecting my input and data that I sent to OCD, our Morgan Supply Company,
yeah.
Collect the data, and then they pass it on to whoever manages OCD.
Okay, fine, thank you. And did you get any feedback from Dr. Lemire about why the variability of the 23% and 34%?
To the best of my recorder, I believe I didn't, but because Dr. Paul Lemire was at a time constraint state, it was actually like a pizza and a other deliverance in other disease.
Okay. Now, thank you very much for speaking.
Mr. Newman, I'd like to take you to page 19 of your evidence in chief, paragraph 73 to 77, and the issue of activity status, and your concerns about the categorisation of your farm, or Broadlands farm, of one of your farms in relation to this, and your description that coming out as a high-risk dairy farm felt like a kick in the guts. And I just wanted to understand what it was that made you feel that was a kick in the guts.
Wrong, if I disagree.
Well, it starts at 73, and you go through and you talk about the assessments that have been done, the end risk score, the overseer number, which you have an understanding of, and then running it through the scorecard, you got an output that said Broadland dairy would be deemed to be high risk dairy. And a restricted discretionary activity. And then at paragraph 76, you start by saying, learning about this feels like a kick in the guts. And that sentence jumped out at me, and I just wanted to understand what it was that made you feel it was a kick in the guts.
Well, I suppose it's like, we've taken means pride in our property,
yeah.
All four properties, and we have a good reputation for being particular, fastidious,
yeah.
Accurate, looking after staff, and we're proud of that.
Yeah.
And now we're sharing the profits of that, and we're retaining staff. And, you know, one feels like you're just doing everything the best you can. And you provide some work for the dairy industry, for kids. And then, just when you get that and you go, wow, we're doing all this and we thought we're doing great.
Yeah.
But we're actually not. But it's not, none of it's visual.
I mean, obviously you're running fairly high production dairy operations, aren't you? Yeah. And so if, and I must say that I read your evidence, I looked at the photographs, I haven't been to your farm, but from the photographs and from what I can see, it does look as though you're running a good operation there. The title of the activity status, I don't think, is intended to suggest that you are a risky operator. One thing that I do is I sit in the district court and I hear prosecutions under the Resource Management Act, and there are dairy farmers who come before the district court and I see pictures of their operations, which look nothing like yours. So I can say that to you. If, instead of saying you are a high-risk dairy farm, it was more similar to the other categories, which were low-intensity farm, moderate-intensity farm, and high-intensity farm, would that be any more palatable to you in terms of a description? Yeah, all right. Because you do acknowledge that in terms of running a high-production farm, if there were poor management, and I'm certainly not suggesting that you might be likely to do that, but let's say you sold the farm and somebody else came on board and they didn't run it well, then that would increase the risk that there might be greater discharges of nitrogen into the groundwater or even into surface water. You understand that, don't you?
I understand that.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Okay. In terms of your four farms, do you adopt a similar management approach to this one? Do you ever consider whether you use a more mixed model for any of those farms in their circumstances, possibly reduce the inputs or reduce the milking or reduce the carrying of them?
Yes, indeed, right. Yes,
right. And when you've gone through that, have you used either Overseer or any other calculations in terms of what the discharges may be as part of your calculation?
No, we haven't, because that's coming up, we haven't planned as Overseer.
Yeah, to
as a model, and it's quite a shame. And so we would have analysed different ways of doing things. The result is always profitable. And surely we're not focused on profit at the expense of ruining the environment, because that's not our thing. But we can't. We have no model to compare what's for the environment for our farms.
No, I'm not asking you to cut the ground up and make it cheap. What I heard you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Overseer doesn't help you as a management tool. It's simply a way of doing the system after you've made management decisions.
That's very good on that part.
And what would help you more would be if you had a tool that would give you some guidance about those things that you could then take into account when making management decisions.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
If one of the issues that the court is considering is possibly having two gateways for activity status, and if obviously it was to be one of those gateways, but there were not many farmers that wanted to use that, how would you compare your sort of 30 or whatever kilograms per hectare of nitrogen lost in terms of the risk element from it? When you look around the country, there's a whole range of information about nitrogen loss rates using Overseer. Do you have any views on how comparison could be made?
And so there's currently, when farmers get the Overseer result, we also get a ranking of where we are. As opposed to the other farmers in our planning period. So we get a comparison with the average, medium, or high for these others in the area.
And that's, would that be within the PC1 area or part of the PC1 area or what?
To the best of my knowledge, I think it would be the PC1 area.
arising from the court's question?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Newman.
Thank you.
Do you swear by Almighty God that the evidence you're about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cameron.
Afternoon.
Can you please confirm for the court that your full name is Bruce Al Cameron?
Correct.
You're a sheep and beef farmer in the Lower Waikato Ekwinu?
Correct.
And you're the branch chair of for Auckland Federated Farmers?
For South Auckland Federated Farmers.
And you produced a statement of primary evidence dated the 28th of July 2023?
Correct.
That's found at Volume 304, Tab 1. Do you have any corrections you want to make to that evidence?
Yes, I have one correction. Point 114, in the boy car, where I had in there, they turn over 14 times the body weight per day. I'd just like that taken out. As much as I understand that, but I can't find the actual, I'll say, scientific evidence to where it came from, so it's good.
Just wait a second while the court turns to that paragraph.
Mr. Cameron, have you made your own observations of them turning over the silk?
Very much, yeah.
Right, and without necessarily putting a number on it, how would you describe that turnover from that you've observed?
I'll put it another way. Years ago, when I didn't have any fences along my main drains and that, I used to go to a couple of points and check them because the cattle fences would get stuck in them. And I could just go to a couple of points, okay, it's all just duty. I go looking for the cattle fences. Now that they're all fenced, I'm back to duty water again because there's a koi carp in there. And you'll see quite a bit of evidence of the turnover of the silk and the carbon is getting the drain.
All right. Just for the purposes of how it works with your photograph 26 and what you've said, and not wanting to put words in your mouth, if we deleted 14 times their weight and put in words such as substantial amounts, would that be your evidence?
Yes, yes, I'd be more than happy with that, Your Honour.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
So with that correction, Mr. Cameron, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge of
it? It is.
Thank you. You attended the Farm Systems Expert Conference and signed the joint witness statement dated the 13th of September 2023, didn't you?
Correct.
Madam Registrar, I have a document. Just for the benefit of the members of the court, this map was questions were asked of the Director General standing with us during the second week of the hearing about this map. So, Mr. Cameron, you have before you a map that was presented to the Director General standing with us. Can you please confirm that this map was prepared by Federated Farmers in the ASIC Institute?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
And that map is a map of your property with the MFA low slope map over areas that overlaid on it. And it is a best estimate of the location and extent of femoral, intermittent, and permanent waterways on your property?
Yes, it is. I have done on my farm mapping in
come up with an extra 9Ks, and when Federated Time has got hold of it and re-looked at it and basically added another 5 kilometres of femoral line, to be honest, it scared the hell out of me, the implications of that. So yes, it is correct.
And this map also shows the location of permanent and temporary fences.
That's correct. All the dark blue, slightly larger lines are all the permanently fenced off permanent roadways, and some of that is intermittent as well.
But that map doesn't show your setbacks on there, does it?
No.
Can you please produce that map, I think, as Exhibit 5?
Oh, no, I think you're exactly right. Exhibit 5.
And Mr. Cameron, you listened to the hearing online when we were at Auckland, and you've been here present for the majority of the hearing in Hamilton. Were there any brief preliminary comments that you wanted to make?
Yes, Your Honour. I've been involved with this process since about 2014-16. I watched on in Auckland while it was online here, watched all that, and then we were observing here. One of the observations that I've come through with is that some of the expert witnesses that's come through, I really wonder how much they've spent time on the farm or on different farms, and some of the implications that have come up, like fencing setbacks, fencing requirements. And I'm sitting there as a farmer looking at how I can implement all that, and I find it extremely challenging. I sort of look at it, it's easy to, I say, sit on a computer or draw up a plan or regulations for a farm, to look like, I think, a video program called Swim City. It's easy to sit at a desk and draw it up, but the practicality on the farm is a very different issue. I think another thought that I've gone to remind is it's easy to draw up plans and regulations when the cost of carrying them out doesn't come out of your pocket. And that's where I think, as a farmer, us here are, you know, have got concerns in that area. Not that we want to not do anything, but it's got to be achieved.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron. Please remain seated and answer any questions the court will have for you.
Thank you.
Does your property drain in the lake, Whangapai? I'm sorry, I'm not very good at pronouncing this. Whangapai.
Whangapai, it's correct, yes.
It does. And you may have heard some of the questions I put to Mr. McGibbon earlier about how this plan changes the first start on a journey, and some of the attribute states within this plan change have not been developed. And one of the issues there is regarding lakes, and so the short-term attribute states for lakes haven't been set. And as your property is within the lake catchment, that will affect you. So, first of all, did you know that?
Yeah, I know I'm in the
if you look at the tables at the back of the game change one that set out what the attribute states are for various subcategories?
I've looked at them, but look, I wouldn't be able to recall them.
Okay. With those tables, assuming that it's a 10-year target for lakes will be set at some point, and it's seen in the 2024 plan change, you do understand, don't you, that would be relevant to your farm and what you may need to do on your farm and your farm environment there?
Yes.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
Well, before I go through this, I'll say three categories. It's permanent, it's got water all the time. Intermittent is one, to me, is one that dries up in the summer. And then ephemeral is when, after a rain event, there is a flow path across the ground. I think in my evidence here, I've put, if I could refer to one photo, and this is where we get. It just gets difficult as to how we start defining some of these streams of ephemeral waterways. Photograph. On page 28, photograph 15. Both those photos are taken from the same place, one pointing one way, one the other. That's of Pantadiga, it's a very narrow, shallow waterway which I put in to catch the water coming off the hill. And on that photo 14, there was a puddle there, but I took that, it had been heavy rain that morning. And all these photos, all the nice green ones I took at that time. So that's where I had issues of trying to define what is an ephemeral. And I think the questions came up on the hearing in Auckland of, I can't remember if it was Mr. Scarsbrook or Broxoff, whereas they were working with Auckland to come up with a definition of what an ephemeral, what the various streams were. So I went and looked on the regional council there, and I think it was two or three pages of working out definitions, and I likened it to an upside down willow tree of how you went down to define what was what, and then it was also saying that you're going to have to go onto the, it'll probably take two trips onto the farm after 20 to 60 mm of rain within 24 hours or something to go determine whether it was an ephemeral stream. I mean, this is all getting exceptionally complicated, and also the cost of having somebody coming out to define what is ephemeral after a rain event. So I look at all these, I'll say shallow ones here, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, is really, I call them all ephemeral streams, or ephemeral, you know, I use the streams, I'll say flow paths, and it's more keeping the water in runoff from the hill off the paddock to prevent flooding.
And looking at the photographs that you provided, would you say
No, I would look at them and say that they are preventing critical source areas. I mean, by giving the water away off the ground to stop the pumping and stopping it happening. So I feel they're alleviating critical source.
I mean, in the photographs, they're very well grassed. And so, you know, the water's run gallon, that shouldn't be a source of sediment, I would think. Looking at, just moving on to photographs 18 and 19 in the river, it's a few pages further along.
Yes.
Really helpful image of, you know, before and after image of a flood. How often does that flood that you show there in photograph 18, how common is that sort of thing? What's the frequency?
Generally once a year, but that might only be, but then I might miss out a year or two altogether. So it's not that common. But they do happen.
And you do mention in your evidence that from time to time the drains are cleared. And is that a similar process to what the previous witness described? A digger comes along and digs out bits of trees, woody debris, bit of sediment.
Yes.
Sort of stuff. And do you clear that away, or is that just left on the bank?
No, it's just when the digger pulls it out, he just puts it on the bank on the pool goes up, and I leave it generally a year, and then it comes out. It's too weird for me to use it dry out, and I just go through the situation. But like this growing here in question, I think I've been on the property about 50 years now, and I think I've done that about twice. So it's not, it stays pretty good. I say, Koi Kau have, I might say there's, they get in and some of the flows there, burrow into the banks, they keep the silt moving, so when the flood comes through, it's kind of suspended and it washes it all out, which you can say is one of the positive. The only thing the Koi Kau don't understand is, I don't want them doing it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So, on that side, the effect.
Now, I can see a little bit of bank erosion in photograph 19, on the right there. And we've heard quite a bit of evidence that you know, bank erosion is a process of delivering sediment to the streams, that some of the sediment that needs to be managed is the sediment that is derived from that sort of bank erosion. And that's a fenced drain, so that bank erosion there is presumably a natural process, or is that where a Koi Kau would?
No, that's above the where Koi Kau would get to. It's, I think the that's probably that will be flood going through there that's taking some of the vegetation off the side of the bank.
So if bank erosion is occurring, does that mean that over time, and you've been on your farm been watching this for 50 years, are the streams getting wider and wider and wider?
No, they're not. No, they're not.
So what's the sort of overall consequence of the bank erosion?
I
would have thought that the bank erosion would make the streams channel get bigger and bigger and bigger. But
yeah.
If you say they're not, the channels aren't getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
No, they're not. I was interested in the evidence given in Auckland that there even 60% of the silt is actually coming from within the stream. And so at least 40% is actually coming off the land. With this here, it's actually a very good question. But I haven't found the streams getting any wider. What I have observed on one particular stream, I cleaned it out with a digger, and so it was all nice and smooth. And in the next couple of years, I think I sprayed it, and I've actually found that that is within, when it was nice and smooth, all the water flowed out evenly. When I got some grass growth in that in the stream, the cattle didn't have access to it. The stream very widely started to snake, and then it was, and then it started digging into the bank more. Whereas, the main this probably my answer the question that by keeping a straight channel, I'm not getting the widening.
Yeah, well, streams don't flow in straight lines.
No, no, not that.
If you make it right, that's going to be that meander.
Yeah. So, yeah, I actually feel it's better to keep the straight and clean. I used to clean them out every year. That was when I first was on the place, because the land that was, there's an element of, I'll say, run down about it, so I had to get all the swamps. There'd been drains in them, but that'd all been, I'll say, left, and I had to get them all cleaned and open again. And but now I only do the memory, like they said, this one's probably only done twice, but others, the smaller ones, probably every 3 to 5 years now.
And just one last question in the photograph 18. Is that water that we can see in the photo, is that oil cells and you know, really brown water, the light doesn't help at all?
No, it is quite brown. But the catchment to this isn't that big, but it does, the headwaters of the catchment is off very steep country, and where Kim Robinson was here yesterday with Lock Hill, I'm already flat far in comparison, and I always thank my neighbours, I see, for all the flat land that I have, because I've got your hills down here now. So I thank them for my flat land. But so there is still coming off. It's limestone country, and when it rains, it comes down very quick.
Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cameron. Just one question. I'm interested in the effectiveness of different buffer widths. And various figures between 3 metres and 10 metres have been discussed. And the main purpose of that is to try and stop silt from the land or sediment from the land getting into the streams. How effective do you think that would be, given the fact that there are some channels that bring a lot of water in particular places of the stream, parts of the stream, rather than evenly along the whole stream? Do you have a view on that?
No stream or paddock flows evenly from the stream back up, that the water would just flow naturally straight on. It finds easiest path. And so therefore you get points where the water, when it comes off the paddock, it generally comes off in, again, depending on the size of the paddock, but it might be 2 or 3 points where it actually flows from the paddock into the waterway. So where's the flow path into the stream here, a setback is good. Where there's actually no flow path off the land into the stream, a setback's not going to achieve anything, because there's no actual flow path from the paddock. The other thing is, I mean, it's parties are looking at a 10 metre setback, and to me, that would be a total disaster when they talk about planting that and vegetation, because when these floods go through, and you get some serious floods go through, the amount of debris, and I think they refer to the slash, or they call trees and shrubs, being picked up by the flood and then deposited on either fences, drains, bridges, and that does a lot more damage. The other thing why a big setback doesn't work for me, wouldn't work for me, is what I do with the mole plow is I drop it into the drain. Now, we would refer to a mole plow. It's about an 18-inch blade with a tool on the bottom. I drop that into the drain and I pull it out into the paddock, because on the edge of the drain, it dries out hard, so it's effectively a dam from the paddock. So if water can get into the paddock and sit there, whereas because the drain bank holds it, whereas by putting this mold plough into the drop into the drain, it's probably out, right out of the paddock as far as I can. That lets that the water in the paddock get away, and it works very well. So by the 10 metre setback, it wouldn't work. I couldn't do that.
Okay, well, in areas where you're putting your mold drain and things like that, would there be any benefit in putting in what I think Mr. Robinson called a filter?
That's a totally different concept, because he's catching the, I'll say, the water coming out of a out of some gullies, and he's capturing it through a filter there, whereas this is, if I refer to that photo on page 14 and 15, years ago I had that, that was a really good pattern. So I put an overflow pipe into it and run it right back up to this drain, but over the time, I think the ground got the pipe washed out. So I dug it out to start looking at replacing it, but when I dug through the drain bank, something absorbed this water there, and that's where I flipped to putting mold plough in it, which worked really well. So in this case, the grass is my filter for it before it goes down to the ground.
Okay. Thank you. Very helpful. Thank you very much. Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you. Any re-examination? Sorry, questions were asked. Very good, Mr. Cameron. Thank you very much for your evidence and your excuse.
Thank you.
And Ms. Edwards, we'll take the right now. Back at 2:15, I think you've got one more, Mr. Berry. I think this is your next witness.
Thanks, Mr.
Berry. Thank you.
Yeah, it's more.